Gorbachev future, some, you seem more serene about the future of that society.
Well, the danger, of course, is that he'll fail, and then we have a putsch with the army or something. Yeah. It's called, I wonder, or the old party revives.
Yeah.
Is it really Ordnung muss sein, of his monks, they've got to,
yeah.
I mean, tidy up.
Yeah.
Nobody's going on these silly lines.
Yeah.
Well, could happen. Could happen. It will not happen in Eastern Europe, even if it happens in Russia. Therefore, Czechoslovakia is too prosperous for that to happen.
Yeah.
So it's Hungary.
Yeah.
Poland is not, but there are so rebellious that it won't happen there either.
Yeah.
Russia might subside into some sort of semi-dictation. Might. But I think force of increase now shall never in our lifetimes, yours, not even yours, completely lie under. I don't think we should go back to the pre-Gorbachev system.
Yeah.
Don't think so. For my reasons. Because the depths have been stirred up.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know what they'll produce, but not that. It won't quiet down. It'll go on fermenting. The nationalities will go on rebelling. The peasants will go on demanding. The army will go on fussing. And so on. Something that I mean is turmoil. It'll continue for a long time. Think of the warlords in China.
Yes.
Quite a long time.
Yes.
I don't hold that hopes for peaceful democratic Russia. But I don't think we'll get a freezing up again.
You see any danger of civil war?
After 48 there was a freezing up again, not quite. What?
You see a danger of civil war?
Yes, that could happen. Mm-hmm. That could happen. Not absolutely clear. Who the sides would be.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, who leads the...
The whites.
Who leads the whites? What do the whites want?
Yeah.
Suppression.
Pamiatas.
Pamiatas and so on.
Yeah.
I told you about this.
Yes, you did.
Pamiatas as well. No, not the analogy. The official theory now is that it's the secret police are behind them.
Mm-hmm.
Not impossible.
Not impossible.
No, I don't think I'm too pessimistic about Russia, because I think once you have a long tyranny and then an explosion, the ferment begins. It may be uncomfortable, may lead to disasters here and there, but don't think it will simmer down. I don't think it will even happen in China, that even though there's something goes turning it up. At worst in Russia, if somebody a very powerful body of soldiers and economists come into power, they might become a Japan.
Mm-hmm.
A sort of totalitarian capitalist regime.
Yes.
They're organized.
Yes.
An organized capitalist regime of a very disciplined kind. Not possible in Russia.
No.
They're too anarchical.
Yes. Too big.
Too big and with not enough of a constitutional tradition.
Yeah. Or a tradition of obedience.
Well, that they do it. That they do it.
They have a tradition of obedience, but they don't have a tradition of efficiency, so it doesn't.
The important thing about Russia is the main body of 19th century revolutionists were Russians. They were not Germans. Despite Bismarck or these predecessors, they were not really French. There were some people in France, but they weren't completely. The Russian revolutionists made the revolution in the end. And in other words, there's enough romantic indignation in that country, and enough readiness to make sacrifices, I would think, in Russia and in Eastern Europe, for me to be reasonably optimistic that we will not sink down into the original slough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the bog.
Not the bog.
No, not the bog. Yeah.
Good, good. Your wife said something to me interesting last week, and I thought very perceptively, which seems confirmed by this discussion. She said, you know, he's so Eastern European. I'm Western European. He's the East, she said.
Correct.
Correct.
And certainly, it means they have feelings about Russia and about the east of the Elbe.
Yes, yes.
Not even in the east of the Rhine, I think.
Yeah.
Even to some extent.
Yeah.
No, she's not.
Yeah.
I don't like the French, you know that.
Yeah.
Well, that's very bad, you see. I like the Italians, but I couldn't live there. I mean, I'm not part of their culture. Whereas towards the Germans, I have a certain sympathy, in spite of everything. I understand German poetry, German literature much better than I, or I like it more. I get more from it than I get from French. And I get a certain amount from America, which is not, in that sense, my wife's sense, all that Western.
Yeah.
There are elements of America, East European Jews in
yes.
New York, of Germans in the Middle West.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Right.
The WASP
yes.
ascendancy, in my time, has not been all that ascendant.
Yeah.
But she's right. She's right. I mean, what she feels about me is a certain drama in the house. You see, certainly my Russian roots are not dead.
Yeah.
And when I meet Russians, I become excited, I become interested.
Right.
This is even true when I meet Germans.
Yeah.
And I think she's right. And when I'm in Salzburg, the food I like to eat is Austro-Hungarian,
yeah.
not French.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not, she's right, I'm not part of some kind of long list. Funny, she's right, I never thought of that, but it's true.
Well, that was a rather perceptive thing to say.
My political views are terribly Western. I mean, my mild liberalism, which I've been hit on the head. This doctrine right enunciated to about the fact you never know what you are appealing.
Yes.
A lot of stuff under the surface
yes.
you can't possibly guarantee.
Yes.
That is cross one said, in that case, can't reform it. Against all reform, against all reform, can't say that.
Yeah.
And yet, I think there is that much to be said in favor
yeah.
of a certain kind of conservatism. But it's true. I think probably I'm affected by the horrors of the Russian Revolution. But I'm not altogether consciously born by influence, by the destruction of human life and human decency, by this movement, which makes everything which is not like it.
Yes. Well, I'm sure. I'm affected by it in the same
Surely.
Way.
Surely.
Completely affected by it. It's the dominant event of my life was the Russian Revolution.
Of course.
You know,
of course.
And I had 30 so years
my,
before
so
I was
my,
born.
Why did my parents come to England? I mean, yes. Though they weren't, I never felt English in the least. I don't know. I never have. It's not quite what I do feel, but not that at least, you see. But the ideals which I have, come from reading 19th century Russian writers. And that's a very terrible thing to say.
Why terrible?
Because it's not Western. Of course it's not, but I mean, Turgenev, Belinsky, Herzmetz. Not Chekhov so much.
Why not Chekhov?
Because he's a little bit too unidealistic. Because he describes life exactly as it is, because he's extremely realistic and deeply pessimistic.
Yeah.
Because it depresses me a little too much.
But I do feel as a prose writer, he's
marvelous.
Absolutely unbelievable.
I tell you what, he's a genius, without a doubt, and also he does describe life as it is.
Mm.
The most realistic writer ever has been
yeah.
is Chekhov. Exactly what life is like. When you read him, you know, this is it. This is it. It corresponds to everything.
Terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Ward 6 is the most depressing, unremitting short story.
No, I mean,
in
if you take the Cherry Orchard,
language.
Take the plays. The Cherry Orchard, the Three Sisters, Seagull, and all those. Nobody in any of them is any good.
Yeah.
Some characters are more sympathetic than others. None of them will succeed.
Yeah.
Can't. But if they do, they're awful.
And you want, and you feel spiritually, you want an escape from that kind of closure. You feel hemmed in by it.
You know, I'm sufficiently, yes, I believe in the possibility of improvement, but not the possibility of transformation. That's all.
November 1989. I wanted to ask you about Russian liberalism, because someone said to me that I was a Russian liberal, and I suddenly thought to myself, what does that commit me to? And then I thought, well, the only person I know in the world who will know with real precision what a Russian liberal is, and more precisely what distinguishes a Russian liberal of the early 20th century particularly from any other kind of liberalism on offer, obviously the British one. If you had to distinguish between Russian liberalism and European liberalism, and more specifically British liberalism, what would you say?
Conditions are very different in Russia. And if you can't quite draw an analogy, you can. You can say, for example, that Milyukov is an absolutely classical Russian liberal. Well, when I said this to my friend Leonard Shapiro, he said, he opened the door to revolution. He's a traitor, not roughly speaking. Mm-hmm. Dr. Katkov, my Russian friend, thought the same. But I said, look, Milyukov's ideas were more or less identical with the Mr. Asquith.
Yeah.
No, I could say that he was revolutionary. I mean, more right, he wanted to end the Tsarist regime. That's the general view.
Yeah.
We see, well, conditions are different. Well, there's something in there, not enough. But Milyukov is, of course, he was a very boring man. Very boring.
Famously boring.
Famously boring.
Yeah.
You see, I can tell you a story which will mean something to you.
Yeah.
You have a sensibility to the Russian language.
Yeah.
I heard him deliver a lecture. The only time I ever saw him was in Paris. I saw, as a, what was I then, schoolboy, I think he had been an undergraduate my first year.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Russian paper, it's called Dernière Nouvelle, Последняя Новости. He was the editor.
Yeah.
It was an excellent paper, because people wrote for him, liberals, intellectuals, not many advertisements, written for other liberals, intellectuals, therefore. It was absolutely clear of everything which disfigured other papers, you see. It was a kind of emigre paper of a high intellectual and artistic order. And all kinds of interesting people wrote about Stravinsky, about Prokofiev, about Nietzsche, about, you see,
just
it was
your kind
daily
of paper.
Daily paper, and yet highbrow.
Yeah.
Inevitably highbrow, which is what Russian liberals.
Yeah.
Inevitably were.
Yeah.
Well, he was delivering a lecture, and he said, there is a movement here in Paris, normally called the Eurasian movement. You know about that.
Yeah.
Now, the Asiatic Russia is far larger than European Russia. Why is it called Euphrasia? Why shouldn't it be called Aziopa? Aziopa sounds like Ethiop, which is the Ethiopian, which is the Russian for barbarian monster.
Yes, yes.
Ethiop is an insult.
Yes, yes.
Ethiop.
Aziop.
It means the blood sort of, nigger.
Yes.
But even that cruelly African barbarian, Ethiop.
Yeah.
The visual country is called Abyssinia in those days.
Yeah.
However, this was, by the way, how bad a boy he was. On a battleship. No, Russian liberalism, it grew up under very different conditions. English liberalism is the result of Whiggery, roughly speaking. It's a form of what they believe in, who is the central figure in British liberalism. John Stuart Mill, Morley, Gladstone in a way. What they wanted was what they believed in. Individual liberty, democracy, parliamentary government. This is true roughly of French liberals too. In Russia, all the freedom seekers were united against the Tsarist regime. Now, there are various wings of that. But they all grew up and the common enemy. It was not true. I mean, liberals, conservatives, of course, were the enemy, but they weren't the enemy in that sense. You could be a conservative and turn into a liberal like Gladstone. It wasn't a traitor. It wasn't a tremendous ideological move of a sort of critical kind which would attract indignant cries. It wasn't like Paul Johnson going right wing.
Yeah.
See what I mean? Yeah. Since in Russia there's a common enemy, there was a certain united front of what might be called roughly the intelligentsia and its followers. Something like that. There was a united front. You could say that liberals were simply an element in this fan-like structure, particular room, this particular fan, but on terms with people to the right of them, to the left of them, of a fairly, I wouldn't say amiable, but tolerant kind. Now, the same is true of liberals elsewhere too, but not. The point is, nevertheless, there are various varieties of it. A Russian liberal, roughly speaking, was a Western liberal. They simply believed in what Western liberals believed and believed to be applicable to Russia. That's what liberals were. Now, there were people who did not believe that on both sides. There were so-called liberals of the right who were not like this. Chicherin was the uncle of the Soviet Minister of Foreign Affairs. He thought that only by very gradual degrees could constitutionalism be established in Russia. Meanwhile, we cling to the Tsar. That is not a liberal point of view. He was regarded as a liberal because he believed in the rule of law, he believed in constitution as such, he believed in progress towards it by very small steps. You see what I mean? And therefore, Herzen, when he went to see him in London, said, when he came in, I felt he was an enemy. I mean, I sensed he was an enemy. Mm. And he wasn't. So that's sort of thing. Herzen was a revolution. Did the liberals want a revolution? Some did, some didn't. But the chief difference is, although they were devoted to Western models, which is what qualified, the question of means was an acute one in Russia, as it would be under any tyranny. And broadly speaking, they were divided into those who wanted a revolution and those who thought it could be achieved by easier means. If you took a vote on what's called Russian liberals of the 19th century, well, take Turgenev, he's the best example. Well, a liberal temper. Nevertheless, he was a gradualist. Why was he a gradualist? Because he thought the revolution would admit the mob. And the mob was as great a danger as the Tsar. In England, there was no danger of a mob, in that sense. In France, more of one, but nothing like Russia. So, Russian liberals, roughly, were persons who wanted to destroy the Tsarist regime by parliamentary methods. That's roughly it.
Yes. To pick you up on something you said earlier, though, I'm interested in the relationship between Russian liberals and culture and the life of the mind in more general terms. I mean, I'm interested that they're so high-minded, for example, and that they're so cultured and that they often have an association with, in the 20th century, what could be called as defined as modernism.
And even now,
yes,
when you meet even these people from the Soviet Union, I think I told you, I thought the intelligentsia was dead.
Yes.
It's not.
Yes.
They've survived.
Yes.
And when you meet them now, they're exactly as they were. They're extremely high-minded. They're very cultivated. They know what they're talking about. Highly sensitive. And altogether, superior members of civilized society.
Yeah.
Or very, so to speak, not only civilized, but morally decent.
Yeah.
And the combination, moral decency was a very central factor in being a liberal, because the government was indecent.
Mm.
And so you see, there's a great, more stress was put on moral purity and decent behavior than on knowledge, culture, although theoretically, knowledge and culture are things.
Mm. But I suppose what I'm, the question I'm raising is why there isn't more Philistinism in Russian liberalism, because Philistinism is a tremendous feature of British liberalism.
Sure.
I mean, Pushpin in poetry and Bentham and some of Mills, John Mills' autobiography, talking about how completely deaf he was to poetry, for example. James Mill rendered him deaf to poetry. And all that strand, and then the kind of Manchester liberalism, very aggressively, kind of grad grind in style and in cultural tone, all of that seems missing in the Russian case, or is it? I mean,
well, it probably existed, all right, but we don't know about it, because they weren't written about very much. I'm trying to think of the Russian novels, not of the first-class novels, which are a little bit rise above their age, but of second-class novels, which give you a much more vivid
picture
of the old set.
Yeah.
For example, I think I told you there's a book written by a man with a pseudonym, Vardinghello. Vardinghello is a 18th century play, violent German storm and stress writer. And that's about, I've forgotten the real name, about Russian society in Switzerland in the 19th century, revolutionaries. It's badly written, it's not a good novel, gives you an absolutely authentic book, you feel it's exactly how it was.
Yeah.
You see, with a Russian prince who is on the left, and you see what I mean, then he's discovered by people around him, and he has to admit to being a revolutionary, and all these other Russian exiles split into various whatnot. No, to answer your question, I think there was probably Philistinism. I'm trying to think of Turgenev's novels, which is where they would emerge if anyone. You don't get pictures of Philistine culture. For example, Ian Forster, in, I think, in the Celestial Omnibus, has a picture of a man who has read a great deal of poetry, and he talks about Keats, talks about Shelley, and he's a howling Philistine, and that was the enemy in that particular school.
Yes.
Well, now, whether people are in Russia, schoolmasters must have been like that. Some schoolmasters must have been like that. There must have been cultivated persons whose opinions were very conventional and were rather shocked by any form of modernism and so on. That's true, but because, I'll tell you, the whole thing arises in the following, at least according to me. The Russian intelligentsia, which is what you're talking about, is a movement which arose in opposition to 95% of the population, state and the peasants and everything else. Because they were not many, because they were persecuted, because of the censorship, because they were attempting to create a new image, a new culture in Russia, which was muddled on the West, which was nevertheless, so to speak, was a dangerous enterprise. They became what Hanyankov says about them. They became a band of brothers, and they felt connected with each other. Maybe like the encyclopedias in France in the 18th century. Doesn't that happen any? And the enemy was the church and state. Countries where the church and state are not enemies don't produce intelligences. In England, the church was not the enemy, nor was the state the enemy. No good saying. Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church are genuine enemies.
Mm. And that produces an intelligentsia.
You have to have an enemy. Black, reactionary, oppressive, obscurantist, or circumconceived. You see? Doesn't matter if it's genuine or not. Circumcised. That happens in Spain, in Italy, in France, in Russia. Poland. None of these things happen. Nobody can say the Church of England is oppressive.
Yeah.
False. You see, at any time its existence. And nobody can say the British state is something. Well, under Pitt, there's people like Payne and Godwin, but they don't like what happened. And they are a kind of proto-intelligentsia. But I don't think Mill was struggling against the terrible conservative and liberal Tory Whig governments wasn't
yeah.
that
yeah.
against the Philistinism,
yeah.
against the pressure of unenlightened public opinion,
yeah.
against ignorance,
yeah.
against prejudice. That's all different. You see what I mean? They weren't massed forces of dangerous, of a powerful kind, but could get you in jail. Struggle against race. In France it was.
Yeah.
You see? Now, that's how the Russian people get. Once you get going in there, then you begin developing certain qualities. First of all, moral courage. If you don't have that, you are not a member, a real member of intelligentsia. Secondly, rejection of tradition, prejudice, religion probably, to some extent. It is organized, the church. and conventional views, which is what the enemy holds. You become embattled,
yeah.
that's what I want to say.
Yeah.
And that is why I think these people, so to speak, were formed what my friend Maurice Barra once called the immoral front. The immoral front was one of the expression. What he meant by it was Jews, homosexuals, protesters.
Yes, the
minorities.
The excluded.
Yes. Yes. They aggressively excluded.
Yes.
Not just excluded, excluded with. And every time someone like that was elected to a fellowship or a job, victory of the immoral front. Moral front of minorities
yes.
against whom
yes.
what's called Philistine public opinion could normally be arrayed.
Yes.
You see, Bloomsbury is part of the immoral front. Pacifists, part of the moral front,
yes.
anything like that, oppositional groups.
Yeah.
Now, in Russia this was a united movement. Some people were much milder than others, and some were terrified of the revolution, and some wanted it. That was the chief dividing line. But they were all united in some kind of respect for an ideal personality, the ideal personality being brave, honest, enlightened, in favor of science, in favor of what's called social progress, in favor of equality, in favor of liberty, all that. You see? That's the whole thing. Now, it just isn't true of free countries. You have to have a despotic country
yeah.
for that to grow.
Yeah.
And of course, in a sense, if you think of the Soviet Union, which is an example, the people under it, and even to some extent under Nazi Germany, and fascist Italy, I mean purer, people were oppositional, were purer, nobler, and better than similar characters in
yeah.
freer countries.
Yeah.
Not necessarily more creative.
Yeah.
But the Italian films, after the fascist regime was over,
yeah.
had a splendid trial because there was an outburst
yeah.
of cultural talent
yeah.
and moral acumen, certain kind of moral quality, you see what I mean, integrity and moral sensitiveness. The same thing is true about these Russians are going to meet now.
I wonder, one of the, I mean, this is an eternal question that, or an accursed
question. Let me give you examples. Michelet is a French liberal.
Yeah.
Now, he doesn't want the revolution, but he's violently anti-clerical. He's violently anti-English because conservative. He's